When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at MSNBC.com/app.
Now it's time for The Last Word with Ali Velshi in for Lawrence. Good evening, Ali.
That was a great story about little changes. Well, they're not that little, but that do happen.
You know, they're small, but they're meaningful.
They're meaningful.
And I think that's why you see a lot of tension in this country, because the progress happens in small steps, but it's happening.
But it happens.
In palpable ways. Yeah.
This evening was interesting. The speech by President Biden, the address from the White House. I thought what was interesting about it was its quiet normalcy. The idea that there are a lack of superlatives. There isn't punditry all over the place. Twitter is not. I mean, it could be a tree falling in the woods. The president of the United States gives an important address.
First oval.
And it's okay.
Said nice things about Republicans and nobody set their hair on fire. And that's
kind
of the way it used to work.
That even in the Obama days, that it would have been hard pressed to, you know, it would have been hard pressed to sort of pay a compliment to the Speaker of the House. And that's what Joe Biden did tonight. The normalcy was the part that amazed me tonight.
Yes, it was peak Biden. And I think a welcome, refreshing change for a lot of people.
Have a good night. And we'll see you next week.
You too, Ali.
Thanks, Alex. All right, think about this. Do you remember where you were the first time you heard about coronavirus? It started as an arcane mention, something happening somewhere else, and then suddenly it touched our whole lives, everyone, everywhere on the planet. Okay, in a few minutes, I'm going to tell you about the reason you're going to want to mark this night down right now, because something historic and world-changing happened this week. So keep listening. Because it tangentially has to do with what President Biden said today and the debt limit bill that he just signed, that he's going to sign. He said, quote, "We averted an economic crisis and an economic collapse." That's what President Biden said in his first ever Oval Office address to the nation about the bipartisan debt limit deal that he expects to sign tomorrow.
It's essential to the progress we've made over the last few years is keeping full faith and credit of the United States of America and passing a budget that continues to grow our economy and reflects our values as a nation. That's why I'm speaking to you tonight, to report on the crisis averted and what we're doing to protect America's future. Passing this budget agreement was critical. The stakes could not have been higher. If we had failed to reach an agreement on the budget, there were extreme voices threatening to take America for the first time in our 247-year history into default on our national debt. Nothing would have been more irresponsible. Nothing would have been more catastrophic.
Now, this is really important, what happened tonight. Historically, presidents have addressed the American people behind the Resolute desk for major national or international crises, disasters, or attacks on America. On October 22, 1962, John F. Kennedy addressed the nation about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Ronald Reagan spoke to the nation following the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster in 1986. On the evening of the September 11th attacks, George W. Bush addressed the nation from the Oval Office. That's the sort of thing that causes the president to do that. President Biden's decision to use his first address to the nation from behind the Resolute desk demonstrates just how close we actually were to economic catastrophe, to a crisis, a disaster, what could be considered an attack on America's economy and the American people's financial well-being, possibly the world's. Now, fortunately, the Chaos Caucus members that would have devastated America's economy lost this round. They were outvoted by a combination of Democrats and some members of their own party, including the House Republican leadership. Last night, during this hour, the Senate passed the debt limit bill on a 63-36 vote, sending the bill to President Biden's desk. The Senate passed the bill a little over 24 hours after the House of Representatives advanced its version of the bill. The New York Times reports, quote, "The Senate vote came after an afternoon of closed-door talks to resolve a last-minute flare-up over Pentagon funding, ignited by Republicans who said the debt limit package severely underfunded the military. By evening, Senate officials and Senator Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina Republican, who had been a chief critic of the Pentagon spending levels, said the pledge from the leadership was sufficient to reassure him and other critics to back the bill, clearing the way for final votes," end quote. The United States will avert an unprecedented default, one that would have signaled to the world that the United States is an unreliable custodian of its finances. And that would have been, that was estimated to possibly have caused the loss of more than 8 million jobs. That was the Chaos Caucus future, averted. I wish the president didn't need to summon all of our national fortitude to stop a crazy faction from setting the economy on fire. But for tonight, we can be grateful that he did and that it worked. The Dow Jones Industrial Average had its best day since November 30th, 2022, jumping 701 points after a strong jobs report this morning. The U.S. economy added 339,000 net new jobs in May, far surpassing economists' expectations of 190,000 jobs. Now, job gains for March and April were also much stronger than previously reported. It's typical that the numbers get revised, but in both cases, they were revised higher. The April jobs number was revised higher by 41,000 jobs. The March number was revised higher by 52,000 jobs. Almost 100,000 jobs we didn't even know were created in March and April. President Biden addressed the strength of the labor market tonight.
We're investing in America and our people and in our future. We've created over 13 million new jobs, nearly 800,000 manufacturing jobs. Where is it written that America can't lead the world again in manufacturing? Unemployment is at 3.7%. More Americans are working today than ever in the history of this country. And inflation has dropped 10 straight months in a row. In this debate, I refuse to put what was responsible for all this economic progress on the chopping block. I can honestly say to you tonight, but I've never been more optimistic about America's future.
All right. I want to talk about how we should think about all of this, America's astonishing economic resilience in the wake of the COVID pandemic, and how it was not just dumb luck, but smart policies, including a different kind of thinking about spending that Joe Biden has that Donald Trump didn't have. Now, Stephanie Kelton, the author of The Deficit Myth, is going to be here to do all of that in just a moment. But I want to go back to what I told you at the top of the show. I want to introduce one more element to this conversation. This is the fact that I mentioned at the beginning that you're going to want to remember about this week. The debt limit hostage taking has been staved off for 2 years because in a couple of years, our economy is going to look very different. We got a clue to this today about why the job numbers that came out, about how it's going to look different in the job numbers that came out this week. So put this one in the history books. For the first time ever, we have job losses attributed to artificial intelligence. 3,900 jobs to be exact. Here to talk about that is Tracy Alloway, co-host of the Odd Lots podcast at Bloomberg News. And the one who brought our attention to this, Tracy, we used to always look at these reports by a company called Challenger Grand Christmas. They tracked layoffs. It was really important around recessions and things like that. And they'd tell you that layoffs are coming and you could sense from that that maybe a recession was coming. You caught something that they wrote about this week, and that is for the first time ever, they recorded jobs lost as a result of artificial intelligence. All we talk about these days, ChatGPT and artificial intelligence, how it's going to destroy democracy and destroy the world. Maybe it's going to be great. I don't know. But this is where the rubber hits the road for a lot of people. It is replacing some jobs.
Yeah, in some respects, it's kind of weird that it took this long to see this start showing up in the data, but you're absolutely right. ChatGPT was released back in November, and fast forward to May, we get this Challenger jobs report. This is the thing, as you mentioned, that kind of lays out all the layoffs that are being announced by companies in the U.S. Comes out monthly. Usually, the list of reasons for layoffs is kind of boring. It's restructurings, maybe some offshoring, things like that. But this month, for the first time ever, they included a category for AI, 3,900 jobs lost, as you mentioned. And I guess the big question now is which careers, which categories are actually most exposed to this risk?
And look, the numbers in context, we created well north of 300,000 jobs in the month of May, 800,000 manufacturing jobs in the last couple of years, 13 million jobs in total. The number's small, but that's why we used the coronavirus example, because the day we first heard about coronavirus, it was a very small thing. There's nothing in this data yet that tells us where this is going. There's nothing in the data that tells us whether AI will create different jobs or whether people can retrain like the Industrial Revolution into other jobs. What do you glean from it? The first time you look at this number, 3,900 jobs lost to artificial intelligence, what do you make of it?
Well, I think you're asking exactly the right question. So people look at AI, and on the one hand, there are people out there, a lot of economists, who expect this to be a huge productivity boost for the U.S. This is going to lead to more efficiency. It's going to lead to new types of jobs being created. But then, of course, you have plenty of people out there who are worried about the immediate impact on their own work, their own careers. And I think it's kind of interesting to note there is a Pew survey relatively recently where I think 60% of respondents thought that AI would have a big disruptive effect in general, but only 28% thought it would affect them personally. So I think people are still coming to grips with what this technology can actually do. We have seen some announcements from individual companies tying AI into job losses. I think, for instance, Dropbox said it was cutting something like 500 people earlier in the year, and they were talking about how a lot of this was driven by technological advances. And again, like, it's kind of going to come down with how society and policymakers actually deal with this disruption. If we get a future where maybe we don't have to work as hard, maybe there's a four-day week or universal basic income or something like that because the robots are doing all the tough stuff, you know, that might be pretty palatable to a lot of people. If, on the other hand, we have lots of job cuts, people end up maybe with worse jobs or less desirable jobs, and a lot of the benefits and the profits accrue to company owners, corporations, that doesn't seem like a very good outcome.
You've just addressed all the things in one answer. That's amazing. You know, when people talk about universal basic income, it seems like a fringe concept, except if you're talking about a world in which the computers do the hard work and you can be an artist. You can be the thing you wanted to be because you don't have to grind for 18 hours a day doing something that you don't want to do. But these are important questions. You said if society and policymakers can figure it out. That's a big ask. That's a tall ask. We've been struggling with policy around disinformation, around social media, around digital communications for years now. And now we're introducing something that's orders of magnitude more complex than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people have a knee-jerk reaction when they hear technological revolution. You think about things that have gone wrong in the past. You know, new technology is always promised to be a standard of living improvement. Everyone is going to benefit from it. But of course, there are losers relatively. But if I could mention one maybe good thing before all of us panic about losing our jobs, especially us media professionals, because, of course, that's one of the things, content creation, that ChatGPT seems particularly good at. But there was a famous study by an economist, David Autor, where he looked at the census data. And I think he found something like 60% of workers today are employed in positions, occupations that didn't exist in 1940. Mm-hmm. So that would suggest that something like 85% of the employment growth that we've seen over the last eight decades or so is explained by new technology. So clearly, we have been able to adapt since 1940. I wouldn't say that the adaptation has always been smooth. I certainly wouldn't say that everyone benefited from it. But this has happened before. I guess the question now is, how disruptive is this really going to be? And how well is society as a whole and policymakers, which we already kind of discussed, how well are they thinking about it?
Tracy, in all of my career as a financial journalist, this is the first such conversation I've had specific to job losses related to AI. So I will remember it. I appreciate how much nuance you brought to this conversation. I'm sure we're going to discuss this many, many more times. We appreciate your time. Tracy Alloway. Joining us now, Stephanie Kelton, a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University. She's the author of The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. And I've got very specific things I want to talk to you about, Stephanie, with respect to the debt limit and all that. But I just want to pick up on this because you talk about the people's economy. So this is real stuff, right? Technology has upended, for better or for worse, our working lives for 150 years. It's happening again.
I think it's always happening, but sometimes it happens in these ways that are very visible to us, these big bursts of innovation. And, you know, like Tracy said, they can be very disruptive. And she's actually exactly right to point out that we create winners and losers when we undergo these sort of major upheavals. And the kind of thing that we're talking about with AI has a lot of people very on edge about what the future is going to look like for many workers in this economy.
We're going to have to keep on studying that. I do want to ask you about something. You heard President Biden saying tonight, inflation's come down for 10 months in a row. So some of that is some good policy making in America. Some of that is global supply chains loosening up and things like that. I had an interesting conversation last weekend with John Kasich, who was talking about out of control inflation. And he said modern monetary policy is to blame for that. And I said we don't actually have modern monetary policy as a policy in place. And that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But let's talk about that. Inflation is coming down. And there was always a fear that if you don't have a gold standard against which to measure your money, inflation will be out of control. That never came to pass.
No, it didn't. And in fact, you know, since we've gone off what you could say officially the gold standard in 1971, the dollar has strengthened yes. about 55% of the time and weakened about 45% of the time. So the dollar has performed remarkably well post gold standard era. So I did hear part of that conversation, this idea that modern monetary theory or MMT somehow brought us unleashed this inflation 40-year high or something like that. MMT is really a lens. It's a framework for analysis. So it helps us understand what policy options are available to us. And as you discussed in the previous segment, Congress did things very differently this time. They took advantage of the policy space that was available in ways that they did not after the financial crisis and the Great Recession. And it is why we had a much more anemic recovery then by comparison, a much deeper hole to dig out of this time. But boy, did we get out of it quickly. And it was through an application of a much more robust fiscal policy response. And MMT, I think, is helpful in explaining why we were able to do that.
Right. But broadly blaming MMT is sort of like blaming critical race theory for everything. Right. It's apples and oranges. Inflation in around the world is in a different place. The interesting thing about what's happened in the last couple of weeks, there is a place to determine how much money we should spend and how much money we should raise through taxes and spending. It's a budgetary process. It's the appropriations process. It's not the debt limit argument process. And you and I have shared the view that that should happen in that venue. And the fact that this happened in this venue, some have argued, well, it was a budget discussion. It was going to have to happen anyway between the White House and Congress. You argue that, no, by doing it this way, strengthens the argument that hostage taking can work sometimes.
I think it proved that hostage taking can work. It reinforced the idea that brinksmanship and hostage taking around the debt limit is becoming the new normal in American politics. I think it undoubtedly worked to achieve at least many of the goals that Republicans hope to achieve by weaponizing the debt limit and forcing that budget negotiation to take place around the threat of a catastrophic default on U.S. government debt.
That said, the good news is we're not on the brink of a default. And in the end, I don't know. On one hand, the White House indulged the toddlers. On the other hand, what was the other option?
Well, I think there were a number of other options. And I think, you know, Ollie, for me, once the any kind of a plan B was effectively taken off the table, and President Biden said the only way we're going to get where we need to get, which is avoiding a default, is through some sort of a bipartisan deal. Well, there were other options, and everybody probably watching your show heard discussion at least of one and maybe of many of those other options, including the 14th Amendment. Maybe you've had discussions about issuing premium bonds or consoles, finding workarounds, the platinum coin idea. There were a number of things kicked around, including saying, you know, all of the treasuries that the Federal Reserve has purchased over the last decade or so, as it's engaged in what we call quantitative easing, this large-scale bond buying, they're already effectively paid off. They're already basically retired. Why not just cross them off, cancel them, so they no longer count toward the debt ceiling limit? So there were a lot of options. President Biden was committed to trying to find, and indeed he did, a bipartisan solution, but it's not without costs.
Yeah, and that cost will rear its ugly head in another couple of years, if not sooner. Stephanie, thanks a million. Always good to talk to you, and always a lot more that we leave on the table for another conversation. Stephanie Kelton. All right, coming up, breaking news about a Jack Smith subpoena in the documents case and new reporting that the Fulton County probe could be expanding. That's next.
Here on MSNBC, we are staying on top of several fast-moving stories.
Today's news requires more facts.
A new report finds the climate crisis is getting much worse.
More context.
We are seeing record numbers of people crossing into the United States just in the southern border.
And more ground covered.
The mission will continue to carry out regime change in the Gaza Strip.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
All right, there's a breaking Trump investigation news tonight in two of the criminal investigations involving the former president. In Fulton County, Georgia, District Attorney Fonnie Willis has been investigating Donald Trump and his allies' efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election in Georgia for 2 years. Now, new reporting from The Washington Post indicates that Willis's sprawling investigation could extend beyond Georgia state lines to include Trump's activities in Washington, D.C. and several other states. The Washington Post reports, quote, in recent days, Willis has sought information related to the Trump campaign hiring two firms to find voter fraud across the United States and then burying their findings when they did not find it. Allegations that reach beyond Georgia's borders, say the two individuals who spoke on the condition of anonymity to talk candidly about the investigation. At least one of the firms has been subpoenaed by Fulton County investigators. In recent days, Willis's office has asked both firms for information, not only about Georgia, but about other states as well. Trump contested the 2020 election results in Georgia, Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The District Attorney Willis appears to be exploring the possibility of charging Trump and his associates using Georgia's racketeer-influenced and corrupt organization statute. That's RICO for short. There are new developments tonight in the Mar-a-Lago documents federal investigation as well, with the New York Times reporting that Donald Trump and his lawyers have been unable to locate the sensitive military document that Trump was heard discussing during a July 2021 meeting at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. The Times reports, quote, shortly after learning that former President Donald J. Trump had been recorded discussing what appeared to be classified material describing military operations for confronting Iran, federal prosecutors issued a subpoena to his lawyers seeking the return of all records that resembled the document he mentioned, two people familiar with the matter said on Friday. But Mr. Trump's legal team has informed the Justice Department that it was unable to find any such records in his possession, the people said. It is unclear whether prosecutors had been able to track down the documents themselves, leaving open the possibility that the material remains at large or that the famously blustery Mr. Trump incorrectly described it on the recording. Okay, there's a lot there. Joining us now is Glenn Kirshner, former federal prosecutor and an MSNBC legal analyst. He's the host of the Justice Matters podcast. I don't know where to start. I want to talk about both of these things. Let's talk about this Mar-a-Lago document, first of all. There was speculation, Glenn, in the beginning that the American government sometimes overclassifies things. Who knows what he took? He stuck it in a bunch of boxes. A military document that maybe has to do with a confrontation with Iran? I mean, there's all sorts of national security reasons why that would be a major, major problem. But what's the situation here? There's apparently he was caught talking about it, but they say they don't have the document.
Yeah, you're not kidding when you say there's a lot here, Ali, to unpack. So, look, Donald Trump, we have all heard him claim that For example, the documents that he took with him when he left the White House, when he left government service, were somehow automatically declassified when he decided to take them. We've also heard him say that he could essentially think them declassified. He could declassify them with his not mind. Well, first of all, automatic declassification and telepathic declassification are not things. But now we have Donald Trump reportedly on an audio recording saying, I've got this classified document here and I'd love to share it with you, but I probably can't because it's classified. You know, everything you say is admissible in the court of public opinion, Allie, but not all of it is admissible in a court of law. People may not appreciate, you know, when people talk about Donald Trump's criminal intent is going to be so difficult to prove. Well, guess what? Prosecutors get to introduce at trial any statement they want that Donald Trump made, because under the rules of evidence, it's a statement of a party opponent. So they will surgically present incriminating statements. Donald Trump's lawyers are prohibited under the rules of evidence from introducing any of Donald Trump's out-of-court statements to prove the truth of the matter asserted. So when we see these statements, conflicting statements from Donald Trump, prosecutors will exploit them by presenting the jury one statement where Donald Trump said, I declassified everything with my mind or automatically when I took them with me. And then they will immediately follow it up with this audio recording saying, I've got this document here about a potential plan for the U.S. to attack Iran, but it's classified, so I can't show it to you. When the jurors can hear those two statements back to back, they will conclude Donald Trump is lying, and that will be sharply incriminating evidence.
About a remarkably important matter. I mean, a military attack on Iran is not. There are small matters and there are big matters. That would be a big matter. Let's talk about Fannie Willis, Georgia, RICO statutes, and the idea that this prosecutor in Georgia is looking at things that the president did. I suppose because they would be similar in fact pattern to the things that they're doing that they're investigating in Georgia.
Exactly. They would prove a common plan or scheme. They could all be a part of racketeering activity. Georgia has very broad, sweeping racketeering laws. We have a rule of thumb as prosecutors. You investigate your case broadly, and then you prove your case in court narrowly. It is clear that Fannie Willis is investigating broadly. And under the Georgia state racketeering laws, she can pull in crimes that were committed in other states. She can pull in federal crimes to help prove a pattern of racketeering activity and a common scheme or plan to defraud in Georgia. So she is definitely in the investigate broadly phase. Now, come August, which is when she asked the judges to please clear their dockets beginning on August 7th, inferentially, because she's going to be running lots and lots of defendants through the courts once the indictments are returned. We'll see just how narrowly she decides to prosecute the case, but it does have the feel of a RICO investigation, and it may end up being a RICO prosecution.
Glenn, as always, you make things so much clearer when we talk to you. I always appreciate you being on the show. Glenn Kirshner, we appreciate it. All right, coming up, are Texas Republicans now truly worried? The Democrats are getting close to turning Texas blue. New legislation targeting elections in the state's Democratic stronghold is on the way to the Texas governor, Greg Abbott, but Democrats are vowing to fight it. That's next.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Turning Texas blue, is it a quixotic quest or a soon-to-be reality? In recent years, Democrats have claimed, hoped, dreamed they could win the state, giving their Senate majority some breathing room, and with its 38 electoral college votes, making the presidential map very challenging for Republicans. Think about it. With three states, California, New York, and Texas, any Democrat running for the White House would be almost halfway to a win. And Democrats have already gotten close to winning in Texas. Remember back in 2018, Beto O'Rourke lost his race challenging Ted Cruz for a Senate seat by just 2.6%. In 2020, Joe Biden lost Texas to Donald Trump by 5.6 percentage points, but that only came out to being 631,221 votes. May sound like a big number, but remember, there are over 30 million people in Texas, which is probably why Texas Republicans have been focusing their voter suppression efforts on Harris County. That's the state's Democratic stronghold, which includes the city of Houston. With 5 million people in Harris County, only two American counties have bigger populations, Los Angeles County, California, and Cook County, Illinois, which you might already know includes the city of Chicago. And with the recent impeachment of Texas Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton, these comments that he made back in 2021 got new scrutiny this week.
We lost Harris County. Trump won by 620,000 votes in Texas. Harris County mail-in ballots that they wanted to send out were 2.5 million. Those were all illegal, and we were able to stop every one of them. Had we not done that, we would have been one of those battleground states that they were counting votes in Harris County for 3 days, and Donald Trump would have lost the election.
By the way, suppressing turnout in Harris County by limiting mail-in ballot applications was not actually what got Ken Paxton impeached and suspended for office. That was a whole web of weird corruption that's worth a few minutes on Google if you haven't been following that story. But also by now, you've probably heard about the bills passed by Texas Republicans targeting elections in, wouldn't you know it, Harris County. From the Texas Tribune, quote, Texas Republicans have muscled through legislation allowing unprecedented state interventions into elections in Harris County, the most populous county in Texas, threatening to drastically overhaul elections in the Democratic stronghold, end quote. Governor Greg Abbott is expected to sign these bills. Republicans in Texas say they are responding to election issues in Harris County. Texas Democrats call that BS. Joining us now is Jane Hope Hamilton, a veteran of government and public policy. She was the Texas statewide director and senior advisor to President Biden's 2020 presidential campaign. Jane, welcome to the show. Thank you for being with us. I've been talking about this to a bunch of people in Texas, and we're still trying to get to the bottom of what is the reason why the Texas legislature, what is the reason that they offer to people in Harris County, in Houston and around Harris County, about why they are taking over things that the county should be administering itself?
Right. Well, you know, what they offer, we can really bypass that. I'm just going to get straight to it to be very clear. The demographic shifts are very concerning, right, to Republicans in leadership here. We are seeing that when we look at places and counties, right, like Harris County, which is the largest and the fastest, has the fastest growing population, it's a majority minority county, which Houston is inside of Harris County. We look at 2016. Guess what? Hillary Clinton won Harris County in 2016. We look at 2020, when I was the statewide director for the now President Biden, he won Harris County in 2020. What it is an attack on our urban centers. Our urban centers are majority minority. We see it right here in Dallas-Fort Worth area, in the North Texas area. We're seeing it in Harris County and in Tarrant County. And make no mistake about it, for Republicans, people like Ted Cruz, that's the battlefield. And as Democrats, we continue to fight and we continue to make progress in these very, very important counties.
But as we've learned, these kinds of things, when they happen at the state level, a well-run presidential campaign can't, in some cases, overcome this stuff. So how does one overcome this in Texas, where we've seen legislators in Texas try to fight back against the things that they do, whether it's abortion bans or other things? The numbers aren't close on the state side in terms of the makeup of the legislature.
Listen, this is not new to Texans. I want to be clear with that, right? While we're talking about this topic today and the attack again on our democracy, we've been fighting this in Texas for decades. The first thing we saw, you may remember, Allie, is the voter ID, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And
yes.
We took it to court. That's right. We took it to court as Democrats. And guess what the court said? The court said, wait a minute, this is unconstitutional. And Republicans lost that. So they came back. And what did we see happen next? We saw that the Voting Rights Act was overturned.
Right.
And with that, that made it harder for states like we're in Texas to just, you know, be able to actually fight in the way that we were used to in terms of taking it to court. But we're going to take them to court again, and we're going to continue on this because this is a fact. You cannot beat back the numbers. What is happening, what we are seeing, is that Republicans in this state, they are fighting the clock. But guess what? This state continuously brings in more and more people of color, brings in more people who are fair-minded people. And one thing that we will not accept is we will not accept a fight, an attack on our voting rights. We will fight back. We will continue to fight back. There is one thing that I always tell people. Voting is the great equalizer. When you have a have and a have not go into a ballot box, those people are the same. They have the same amount of power in that ballot box. And so we will continue to fight this.
From your lips to every voter in America's ears, the one place that you have the ability to be equal to everyone else is when you can walk into that that ballot booth and you can cast your vote. Thank you for that. It gives us hope.
Thank
Jane
you.
Hope Hamilton, we appreciate your time tonight. Well, coming up, we're going to introduce you to the new mayor of a formerly Republican stronghold in Colorado. And there is a lot about this race and Yemi Mobolade's victory that's going to make you feel very good about democracy. That's next. A political earthquake in a conservative stronghold. That's how the Colorado Sun described independent candidate Yemi Mobolade's historic victory in the race for mayor of Colorado Springs. Yemi Mobolade is a Nigerian immigrant and a businessman who first moved to the United States 27 years ago as an international student. He's the first elected black mayor of Colorado Springs after defeating former Colorado Republican Secretary of State Wayne Williams with 57.5% of the vote. It was truly a political earthquake. Colorado Springs had never elected a non-Republican candidate for mayor. Wayne Williams is a normal Republican, though. He didn't support election denialism, which likely cost him Republican votes in a changing electorate in Colorado Springs. Wayne Williams conceded to Yemi Mobolade and congratulated him on an excellent campaign, something rare to see in the era of election denialism. Here's some of what Yemi Mobolade said to voters in his victory speech.
We stand on the mountain of a new era in our city's history. Yes, Colorado Springs will become an inclusive, culturally rich, economically prosperous. Economically prosperous, safe, and vibrant city on a hill that shines brightly. To anyone who doubts that politics can be disrupted, reformed, and transformed into a hopeful experience, tonight is for you. To the citizen who has lost hope in this great experiment and a dream of our founders, what we call the United States of America, tonight is for you. To one in this room who is in utter disbelief that Republicans and Democrats and independents can work together, can find common ground, maybe even like each other. Tonight is for you.
Joining us now is Yemi Mobolati, the mayor-elect of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Congratulations, sir. Thank you. I have so many things I want to discuss with you, but I want to start on that last point, that Republicans and independents and Democrats can work together, that maybe they can even like each other. Tonight, President Biden gave a speech in which he emphasized bipartisanship. He thanked the Speaker of the House. It's not something you see very often with people from two different parties. The man you ran against, the man you defeated, the former Secretary of State, called you and was gracious in the way people are supposed to be gracious in Democratic elections.
Yeah, that's how politics should be done. And I have a theory. I have a vision that I believe that in local politics and cities like mine, we get to transform and disrupt American politics in a way and remind ourselves this is how it should be done. So I'm really proud of Mr. Williams for calling to concede and showing, expressing his support for me and for the city of Colorado Springs.
Let's talk about your view of citizenship that you articulated in your speech. I too am African born, and I'm also recently an American citizen. And those of us who go through that process, who read the Constitution when we get sworn in, who have to study for a test, I certainly don't want to ever suggest that we value this more than anyone else does. But you are caused to articulate what citizenship in this great experiment in democracy is meant to be. And that came out in your speech.
Oh, absolutely. I've been in the country for 27 years. I've been a citizen just the last 6 years. I know what it's like to be on the outside looking in and now to be able to fully participate in this great experiment. It's an honor. It's a blessing. And that's part of the immigrant story. And by the way, we're a nation of immigrants. Mm-hmm. And I part of the immigrant story is just being able to see things with fresh eyes and see the opportunities. I often tell friends and colleagues and my residents in this great city that I know that things are not perfect, but we still have so much to be thankful for and so many opportunities in front of us. Let's capitalize on this. And that is my unique perspective as an immigrant. I get to remind ourselves about the best of who we are as Americans.
But then you come to this country and you have decided that you are either, whether you want to call it giving back or being a full participant, you're doing the thing a lot of people can do. They can run for office locally. They can support candidates locally. They can at least go to their school board meetings and be part of the discussions going on. This is part of the answer. When you say we have much to do, you're the example of what doing looks like.
Absolutely. Get involved. I mean, if you had asked me, I mean, why did you run? You have to be the change that you want to see in the world. At some point, you, instead of looking to others, you look within yourself and you raise your hands and say, all right, here I am, send me. And that's why I got involved. I believe our nation, I believe our world is hungry for a new type of politics, one that transcends the dividing lines of politics, one that transcends the fighting and the name calling and the canceling, and just brings us back to who we are as humans and how, and it's from that wellspring that we can get things done. And it's why I'm really proud of this great experiment that is happening in my city of Colorado Springs.
Well, all of you in Colorado Springs have done right by this election, you and your opponent and the campaign. So it was a pleasure to watch, and it's a pleasure to meet you. And I suspect we'll be talking many more times. The mayor-elect, Yemi Mobolati of Colorado Springs. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having
me. My pleasure. Tonight's Last Word is next. Tonight's last word goes to the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, who delivered a speech entitled Russia's Strategic Failure and Ukraine's Secure Future in Finland today, which included this stunning and absolutely devastating line.
The Kremlin often claimed it had the second strongest military in the world, and many believed it. Today, many see Russia's military as the second strongest in Ukraine. Its equipment, technology, leadership, troops, strategy, tactics, and morale, a case study in failure.
That's tonight's last word. You can catch me tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. for a special edition of the Velshi Band Book Club. This week, we'll be featuring the high-stakes story of one book and one brave author. Return of the Taliban by Professor Hassan Abbas chronicles how the Taliban regained control of Afghanistan nearly 2 years ago after the fall of Kabul. The new account examines their rise to power, their control strategy, and profiles major Taliban leaders. Now, even before the book debuted in the United States, Abbas faced very real threats on his own life from Taliban leaders. So tomorrow, I'll speak with Professor Abbas on his important research and the power of the written word. I often say that books are banned because of the author, because of the content, or because of the ideas, and some are all three. But in this case, the Taliban has decided they don't like this guy's ideas enough that they're willing to kill him. I hope you'll join us for that conversation.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at MSNBC.com/app.